From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And today, the World Anti-Doping Agency confirmed that confidential health information about 10 American athletes, as well as athletes from other countries, has been released after a data breach by Russian hackers. Earlier this week, the hackers released records belonging to U.S. gold medal winning gymnast Simone Biles and tennis stars Venus and Serena Williams. Also this week, former Secretary of State Colin Powell's private emails were hacked and published on a website that some analysts have linked to the Russian government. And more leaked documents from the Democratic National Committee came out. The DNC says that hack was also perpetrated by Russian hackers. Brian Krebs is an independent investigative reporter and the author of KrebsOnSecurity.com. He joins us by Skype. And Brian, why does this keep happening? Why can't the U.S. government or companies and organizations stop these hacks?
Well, I think part of it, the reason is in your question. At the end of the day, a lot of these attacks come down to individuals. A lot of it comes down to actions that individual users take or do not take. For example, lots of companies offer what they call two-factor authentication, which is in addition to your password, they ask you to regurgitate a code that they send via text message or an app on your phone. And this is a really great way of protecting your accounts from getting hacked. But I did interviewed Dropbox's CSO not long ago. They've got 500 million users. He said less than 1% of the users have taken advantage of this security technology, and they've been offering it for 4 years. So there are a lot of things that your average user can do to improve their security. And unfortunately, a lot of times these hacks are the result of the failure to take an action.
So it's the failure to take an action on the part of the individual. And I will say, by the way, as somebody who, you know, like all of us, we now have to, in some cases, deal with these additional measures of security. And they're annoying because you think to yourself, nobody's ever going to hack into my gas bill or whatever it might be. But at the same time, why can't the U.S. go after the hacker after the hack has been done? Can we not hack them back?
Well, we can. The danger is always that there will be unintended consequences, that there will be a cascading effect. We saw this happen when the U.S. and the Israeli government got together to put together that malware that is known as Stuxnet, right? And it was designed to delay or to derail Iran's nuclear ambitions. And it was very successful at doing that, but it spread well beyond Iranian nuclear systems and into U.S. systems and all kinds of other things. So, you know, we have to be very careful about how we consider hacking back, because at the end of the day, what you do is you encourage private companies and individuals to do the same.
Hmm. How would you describe the state of U.S. cybersecurity?
I would say that, you know, it's not very good. We're facing adversaries in countries where they have for a long time placed a tremendous emphasis on educating their populace from a very young age in the sort of skill sets that lend themselves to a mastery of hacking and computer programming. I'm talking about logic, math, and sciences. These are areas where our educational system traditionally does not excel compared to the rest of the world. And also, we have a tendency here to sort of, once we get the security in place, to kind of set it and forget it and hope, just don't touch it, right? Well, the only problem with that is it's hard to find another field that moves faster than cybersecurity. So the defenses that you used a year ago are virtually useless against today's attackers. And if you're not constantly updating those defenses and trying to think more like the people who want to undo all that, then you probably don't know it yet that you're already hacked.
So, Brian Krebs, what should the U.S. be doing? What is the response that should come from the United States?
In this case, unfortunately, a lot of the answers to digging out of this problem comes from taking a longer view. I think we need to really rethink as a country the way that we approach cybercrime, to engage individuals at a much younger age and to target people and to do a better job of encouraging people to get into cybersecurity as a career. Because frankly, one of the biggest problems facing businesses is cybersecurity professionals are just too darn expensive. That's because there's a shortage of them. And so somehow we need to figure out a way to generate more of these professionals here at home. I think one way to do that, the government could do that, is to create a GI Bill for cyber. And I think it would be a very good idea for private industry to be a big part of that.
That's Brian Krebs, author of KrebsOnSecurity.com. Brian, thanks as always.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jeremy.
And now to Minnesota's 2nd Congressional District, where there's some excitement, an open seat. Republican John Klein is retiring, and Democrats are hoping to flip the seat with their candidate Angie Craig, but she faces former right-wing radio host, the Republican Jason Lewis, who The Atlanta calls a mini-Trump. Mark Zdechlik of Minnesota Public Radio joins us from St. Paul for this week's District Profile, our look at congressional races across the country. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
So get right to the Republican Jason Lewis. Was a controversial talk show host. In a 2012 broadcast, he said white people were committing political suicide because they weren't procreating at the same rates as Hispanic peoples. He's denigrated women, just about everybody. Tell us more about him.
Well, he is controversial. He's also was relatively popular among conservative Minnesotans. His radio show was very well known. So he comes into the race with not a lot of money, but a lot of name recognition. But as you note, a lot of baggage, plenty of ammunition for Democrats to dig up on him and point out things that he said in the past when he was working more as kind of an entertainer and an analyst and an outside observer than a guy trying to secure actual votes.
Well, here he is talking about women voters. He said, you've got a vast majority of young single women who couldn't explain to you what GDP means. You know what they care about? They care about abortion. They care about abortion and gay marriage. They care about The View. They're non-thinking. All right, so that's Jason Lewis. But as you said, he's embracing it. Here's a recent ad.
I'm Jason Lewis. Every day on the radio for 20 years, we've talked about solutions to our biggest problems. Now it's time to put words into action. But all the politically correct politicians do is attack people like you and me who want real change.
So, Mark Zdechlik, you say that'll resonate with people who really enjoyed his show. But what about with the party, the Republican Party?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure all this is going to resonate with people who enjoyed his show. What I'm saying is that he has strong, high name recognition. I should say, too, that the candidate says some of the things he said about women, comments suggesting owning slaves is a personal choice. He's saying that those are taken out of context, and Angie Craig is up with a brand new ad putting those very statements out to voters. It's unclear right now whether Republicans in that district will embrace Jason Lewis. We do know that that ad you ran just now came from his primary campaign. It was a spirited campaign, and he came out on top of that, if that's any indication of how deep his support is among Republicans there.
Well, Ed, we just want to note in the Atlantic article, they quote a deputy chair of the Minnesota Republican Party in February, you know, criticizing Lewis. But then once Lewis got the nomination, that same chair, Chris Fields, said, I back him. And so we'll see how that plays out. But meanwhile, there's Angie Craig, former executive at St. Jude Medical in Minnesota. Here's a recent ad from her.
At the company I help lead, our products save lives. I wanted to help our employees live better ones. I'm Angie Craig. That's what I did. Hiring, training, creating new opportunities.
So Mark Zdechlik, tell us more about who she is.
Well, she's a successful businesswoman. She is someone unlike Jason Lewis, who did not have a primary challenger. Democrats got behind her relatively early. She's raised more than $1.5 million. Jason Lewis has raised less than a third of that. She's talking about many of the things Democrats are talking about all over the country, trying to do things to help the middle class, improve the job market, you know, investing in infrastructure, creating jobs by rebuilding roads and bridges, and the list goes on.
Yeah, well, we understand as well that her family's been brought up as an issue. How so?
It's interesting. She is married to a woman. She has 4 teenage sons. It came up very recently in a Facebook post inviting Republicans to a county fundraiser. The person with the local county in southern Minnesota who put that post up also included some pictures of some candidates and their families, and she noted that there was a picture of Angie Craig with her same-sex partner playing a game with her 4 teenage sons. Jason Lewis very quickly put out a statement saying, personal, private lives are off limits, and what should be talked about are the issues. So he got ahead of that very quickly. His background is more of kind of a libertarian background, too, that wouldn't necessarily concern itself with the social issues like that.
Mark Zdechlik, we're talking about Minnesota's 2nd Congressional District. Tell us about the district. What, you know, it's also a character in this.
It absolutely is. This district changed during the last round of redistricting. And John Klein's margins of victory changed rather dramatically. They were much closer after the redistricting following the 2010 census. It lost some conservative voters in the southern part of the district and gained some voters that might be more likely to vote Democratic in the northern part of the district. The district itself kind of spans from the southern Minneapolis-St. Paul suburbs down south well into more conservative farm country in southern Minnesota. But Democrats are so excited about this, not only because it's an open seat, but because the district is now a little bit more welcoming to Democrats than it had been prior to redistricting. And they also feel that with Trump at the top of the ticket, that's going to play in their favor.
Mark Sedeklik, correspondent for Minnesota Public Radio, talking about Minnesota's second. We'll watch this district closely. Mark, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Last year, Americans spent about $43 billion on organic food. Now, that's just close to 5% of total retail food sales in the U.S. But as share of the market grows, different factions in the organic food movement are debating whether bigger is better. John Kalish reports.
Grace Gershuni has spent the last 40 years as an activist, government bureaucrat, and organic food inspector. She recently published a memoir titled Organic Revolutionary. The book chronicles her arrival in Vermont as part of the Back to the Land movement in the early 1970s, and her time working at a rural education center in New Hampshire where Stonyfield yogurt was born. So it was no surprise that the U.S. Department of Agriculture hired her in 1994 to help write the federal agency's first organic food regulations.
And I assumed that they had lawyers, and I would just tell them what the organic idea was, and they would turn it into regulatory language, and then no such luck. So I had to learn regulatory language. Luckily, I was brought up by a lawyer, so I grew up learning how to argue with lawyers, and I found that I had a capacity to do that.
Grace Gershuni left her job at USDA before the Organic Foods Production Act took effect in 2002. The first draft of the regulations was met with more than 250,000 negative comments. Mark Lipson helped lead the campaign. He's now an organic food policy consultant.
The Organic Foods Production Act was really beyond our understanding as a community what it would actually mean to implement it. We didn't really know how to navigate the internal USDA process, and USDA was institutionally hostile to organic agriculture.
Grace Gershuni tells me she's been denounced as a socialist termite by some in the organic food scene and an industry shill by others. She says she's long felt an affinity with small farmers, but she sees the small is beautiful worldview that some organic food advocates cling to as problematic.
I mean, these are the same people who basically say, well, if Walmart is selling it, we can't trust it. I really think desire for that kind of purity is a symptom of the elitism that many people accuse the organic movement of, with some justification.
We're bringing healthier, better-tasting food to the people. We're bringing family farms back from the brink. Organic Valley, bringing the good.
The Organic Valley Dairy Cooperative may play up its connection to family farmers, but the company rang up more than $1 billion in sales last year. The interests of the organic food producers have sometimes clashed with the priorities of the people who consume their products. It's a dynamic that Mark Lipson has seen often during his 30 years in organic agriculture. Lipson wants to see the industry grow and is heartened by the rise in retail sales in recent years.
My entire career, at whatever stage we've been at, there have always been established actors who wanted to cry foul when somebody stepped up to do things at a bigger scale. So when I first started farming, that meant, oh my God, somebody's come in with another 10 acres of organic tomatoes, and there goes the market, there goes the deal.
But Jay Friedman, the head of the advocacy group Beyond Pesticides and a former member of the USDA's National Organic Standards Board, says there's a constant push and pull between forces opposed to watering down prohibitions against synthetics and large-scale organic food producers and processors.
There are players in the industry who want to adopt the use of synthetics on a broader scale than I would like to see. Typically, we'll see greater pressure coming from the corporate side. They see this as more cost-effective, more efficient. These are the elements that have driven us on the conventional side to incredible chemical dependency.
Grace Gershuni says that the concept of synthetic chemicals is poorly understood by consumers, and she calls some in the organic movement obsessed with synthetic compounds and the notion of producing completely pure food. Gershuni says that's not really possible anymore.
The environment is polluted. We can't escape it.
Gershuni advocates less of a focus on the origin of what goes into organic food production and more concern for what has been dubbed agronomic responsibility, maintaining or improving soil and water quality. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish.
Well, whether you're into organic food or not, our resident chef Kathy Gunst is here right now with some thoughts on stuffing your vegetables. Kathy, welcome back.
Hi, Jeremy.
So you've got stuffed flowers here in front of me.
I do. Towards the end of the season, there's still a load of zucchini blossoms and other squash all produce blossoms. And this time of year, the fruit, the zucchini, the squash is slowing down and you can pick the blossoms and stuff them. So yeah, feel free to bite into that. So I picked those this morning from the garden and I put goat cheese and tomatoes and sauteed leeks in there. And then you make this batter just from flour and water. Dip it in and saute it in a bit of olive oil. So good. Zucchini blossoms are extremely delicate. So without getting into a whole sex ed class, there are male and female zucchini blossoms, and ideally you want to use the male. They tend to be the larger blossoms, and those are better to stuff with. So at this time of year, you don't have to worry that much about it because gardens are winding down in many parts of the country. But all kinds of squash blossoms, this beautiful pumpkin orange, the whole thing's edible. You just clean them out, make sure you don't have any bees in there, and you can stuff them with all kinds of things. But that's one of my favorite combinations.
And what about the delicacy of the flower? Is it hard to stuff them without breaking it?
Oh, I'm glad you asked me that. You want to pick them in the morning when they're wide open. And then what I do is I stuff them. You don't overstuff them. You put a generous tablespoon of stuffing in, and then I tie the stuffing in with a chive. So I use the chive like a piece of string, so it keeps it in.
Oh, cool.
So everything's edible. You can make them way ahead of time. They're amazing with champagne or bubbly wine or cocktails. A little labor intensive, but not crazy for the payoff of the flavor. Love them.
Okay, and in front of me, you've also got here something a little more familiar to people who know stuffed vegetables, stuffed peppers.
Yeah, stuffed peppers were something like you found in the cafeteria in the 50s and the 60s, and you weren't that happy about them. So I've tried to reinvent them. I've had incredible stuffed peppers in Turkey and Greece and a lot of Mediterranean countries. These are kind of Mediterranean flavors inside this stuffed pepper. Also picked it from the garden this morning. It's got ground beef or ground lamb that's sautéed with some anchovies and tomatoes and basil. And what I love about these stuffed vegetables is so many vegetables are adaptable and will hold a stuffing, and they can be made a whole day ahead of time. So if you're having dinner or having a party, you can make them on a Tuesday and then just come home from work and heat them up, and you don't have to do anything. And they're whole dinners. You don't really need much more than a beautiful salad and some crusty bread.
And that's delicious, too.
Isn't that nice?
Got a nice spice to it as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of nice spices in there and a lot of fresh basil. So what you want to do when you're stuffing vegetables is you want the stuffing to have a whole lot of flavor. When you taste it, it might even seem strong. Like when I tasted that raw, the anchovy really came through. But now I think it's kind of subtle that it's been cooked and baked for about an hour. And you'll notice I'm serving it at room temperature. Mm-hmm. This is something you do see quite a bit in Turkey and other Mediterranean countries. And I just drizzle olive oil and fresh lemon juice over this pepper. And at room temperature, it doesn't quite feel as heavy. And, you know, in the winter, I might serve it hot. But I love that it's room temperature.
Yeah, and you gave me a nice little lemon here, which I squeezed over the top of it thinking, good job. Why would you ever not lemon something, really?
Well, lemon almost never hurts. Exactly. Lemon well, something. Well, it's a good book title.
Well, the last thing you have here for me is a stuffed eggplant dish.
Yeah, so again, eggplants are very plentiful this time of year, and I took it and I used a spoon or a melon scooper and I scooped out the flesh, leaving the shell, the purple part of the eggplant, intact. And this is purely vegetarian. I sauteed the eggplant with a lot of onions and all kinds of great spices, cinnamon, a little cayenne. I added a little bit of cumin and just a bit of panko breadcrumbs on the top. Mm. And I bake it on top of a fresh tomato sauce, but you could use a bottled tomato sauce. And that took about 20 minutes. And then, you know, again, I made it yesterday and heated up today, and it's all done.
And how much time does all of this take you generally to stuff a vegetable versus doing something else, making something else?
It takes a little bit more time because you have to prepare the vegetable shell and you have to make the filling. But I think the make-ahead possibilities make it worth it. It's a really fun dinner, whether it's for a regular weeknight family dinner or something special on the weekends. And the other thing, if you do have time, is to do a whole variety. You could do that eggplant filling with zucchini. Mm. You can stuff an onion. You can stuff a tomato.
You can stuff an onion?
Oh, yeah. You just kind of use the layers there. The way you stuff an artichoke, you know, you pull apart the leaves, the same thing with the onion. Obviously, stuffed cabbage is a very traditional, famous dish, which I also love. You can scoop out tomatoes and add fillings to that. Grape leaves, the Greeks do that. It's wonderful. It's not quite a vegetable, but it can be. There are a lot of possibilities for stuffing veggies.
And we will put your recipes up at our website, hereandnow.org. Kathy Gunst, our resident chef, thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
The NFL is announcing new steps to address concussions. The league will spend $100 million to improve helmets and fund medical research into the effects of head injuries. Commissioner Roger Goodell unveiled the initiative on the NFL website this week under the banner Play Smart, Play Safe. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com, and he's with us now. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Well, tell us more about what the league is doing now about concussions. What's new?
Well, it's $100 million, but this is over 5 years. The NFL says it's committing $60 million towards developing technology like helmets and $40 million over 5 years towards research. Now, let's put this in context a couple ways. They already said they were committing $100 million, but the NFL exceeded $13 billion in revenue. So $100 million is less than 1% of that. But let's not be churlish. Let's not say it's nothing. It is something, and researchers appreciate the money. We should also note that this comes on the heel of the NFL settling its legal case for over $1 billion for players and future players who might come with claims related to concussions. And until that was done and until there was some certainty around their legal liability, you were mostly seeing the NFL trying to obfuscate and get in the way and deny the fact that concussions cause head injuries. Now, at least they admit it and they're putting some funding behind it.
But there's probably still a lot of skepticism about this, given that the NFL had spent years criticizing researchers who warned about the dangers of football-related head trauma.
Well, not only that, the Roger Goodell, the commissioner, said we're going to appoint a top expert. He said that in July. That has not been filled for years. The person who was heading the what should have been the concussion committee was an unqualified rheumatologist, actually. And then you only have to look at the kickoff game, the Thursday night game last week, the rematch of the Super Bowl, which was a fantastic game. And in many ways reminded us of why we love the NFL. So compelling was this game between the Panthers and the Broncos. But it also reminded us of the horrors of the NFL. Yeah. With 36 seconds left, Cam Newton, Panthers quarterback, takes this vicious hit to the head. It's not penalized, even though afterwards they fine it. And the officials screw up the concussion protocol. He's not pulled from the game. So $100 million is great. If you have rules but don't enforce the rules, what are you really doing about concussions?
You know, there are some people who look at this and say the NFL is not going to last, that at a certain point, this issue could really be a problem for the existence of pro football.
It's so pro football is so popular. It's so unbelievably popular in America. Its ratings rise as ratings of everything else fall. I mean, I know that there are antecedents to here is a sport like horse racing or here is a sport like boxing that were once popular and aren't. But you know what replaced boxing? MMA, which is more vicious. I mean, its proponents will say that in terms of head trauma, it's not. But just look at the bloodiness of the sport. I think the predictions of the NFL's demise have been premature. But I also think if it doesn't do something to at least assure its fans that they're not seeing carnage on the field, they can't rely on the growth of the league that we've seen during the Goodell tenure.
Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Carl Hiaasen is back. Well, he never goes away, and many people wish he would. He is the doggedly satirical observer of all things wacky in Florida, in both his columns for the Miami Herald and well over a dozen books. In his latest novel, Hiaasen weaves together insurance fraud, beach erosion, the mob, reality TV, oh, and real headlines about Floridians. Now, a warning, these may not be for everyone, but they're real. They're in the paper. Headlines like, Manatee Woman Punches Sister During Fight Over Vibrator, deputies say, and Florida woman causes accident while shaving private parts. Carl Hiaasen's new novel is Razor Girl. Janet Maslin in the New York Times calls it irresistible, and Carl joins us in the studio with more about the book and about what prognosticators are calling the swingiest of swing states.
No, geez, I hope not.
Which made me think of like a Frank Sinatra song, you know.
Or something,
yeah,
something else.
Something else. Carl, I think we actually talked at one point when we were talking about these crazy headlines that come out of Florida. I think we did talk about the 2010 true story about the woman shaving herself.
Right, and that caused an accident down in the Keys. She was doing some personal grooming while she was driving, and she crashed into a car full of tourists. So one of my sons sent me that clipping, and I'd saved it, of course, trying in some depraved way to fit it into a novel. How do you improve on it in fiction? And then where would it go? So I said, why don't I start the book with something like that and see what happens?
This is why other authors just get so angry at you, Carl Hiaasen, because you're so lucky. You just have these headlines, these stories about Floridians. How many others in your book? I mean, there's so many storylines. You've got a cop who's had his badge removed because of coloring outside the lines. You've got somebody who shores up shorelines. What's the name of the company?
Sedimental journeys. Yeah, beach renourishment is a huge business in Florida because erosion is a continuous problem, and the beach is an expensive commodity. I mean, we sell the image of beaches and we sell property on the beaches. And so when the beach starts disappearing, they turn to these companies to either dredge up sand from offshore and redo the beach, or actually in many cases they go to the Bahamas and get sand. And the guy in my book, the scammer in my book, decides that Cuba would be a good place to try to get some sand. He's gotten into trouble with the mob because he brought in some really bad sand.
From like a landfill.
There's glass in it. And, so all the kids building sandcastles are sitting there getting shredded. And so the mafia said, you put in a good beach or else.
Well, you've got your central character, Andrew Yancey, who also appeared in your Bad Monkey. He's a former detective now busted down to health inspector for restaurants. A big case comes up when it's discovered that this is so disgusting, so disgusting. Somebody has shaved their beard in a pot of like gumbo or something.
Quinoa. I don't go for the gumbo. No, it's quinoa.
At this health restaurant. Do you get people like health inspectors sidling up to you and kind of saying, well, I got a story for you?
I don't have to do that, Robin, because in Florida, because of the public records law, all restaurant inspections can be looked up online. I go out to eat all the time and the food's great. But if you want to find something that'll make you want to sleep with the lights on, just read a few of these reports from some of the sketchier places. And I take my character, Andrew Yancey, and put him in this situation. And he was a hotshot detective working on like real crime, and now he's literally counting cockroach wings on roach patrol.
But talking about restaurants, I think it was also a restaurant where this huge rodent-like thing runs through, and then the owner says, oh, yeah, that's Hemingway's cat.
Right. He's trying to tell. It's actually what it is there's a species, an invasive species in the Keys that's a real thing that I put in a book called a Gambian pouch rat. Actually, they're called giant Gambian pouch rats, and they were released on an island called Grassy Key several years ago. after they didn't flourish in the pet trade. It's not surprisingly, not many people wanted to buy a 9-pound rat as their household pet. So the business tanked. And this guy in real life, instead of – he didn't know what to do with the rat, so he just let him go. And there are sightings occasionally in the Keys, and it's always intrigued me. So I decided to put a small herd of them in this novel and have them show up in one of Yancey's restaurant patrols. But they're the largest rat on the planet. I know that – that's probably not appealing to you, but it was to me as a novelist.
You could confuse them with a Hemingway cat.
Well, if you're running a restaurant, you're going to say anything. You're not going to say, oh, there goes a 9-pound rat. You're going to say, relax, that's just one of Hemingway's cats.
we're talking about the novel, but this is what you do. You pick up on something that's happening in Florida and you run with it in your columns as well. I'm thinking of one of the recent ones, Rick Scott's, that's your governor there.
Yes.
Rick Scott's list of how to fight Zika in 14 easy steps. One, whenever a new Zika case is confirmed in Florida, I will immediately rush to the county and stage a roundtable discussion. Two, if no roundtables are available, I will settle for a rectangular one. I will begin each roundtable discussion by thanking everybody for all their hard work in the battle against Zika. They, in turn, will thank me. I mean, it's obviously condemning.
It's just poking a little harmless fun at hollow politicians. There's no shortage of them. Part of the job of columnist is you're toppling, you stay on the news. And the fact is, the whole idea that we're tracking a mosquito and that you can trap these mosquitoes, for instance, or, you know, with – I mean, what they're doing now is just carpet bombing it with the mosquitoes and praying they're going to kill most of them. But you know how many mosquitoes there are. And so there is something surreal about this whole battle, because the first week Zika breaks out down in Wynwood, in the Wynwood neighborhood, they run a map saying, don't worry, this is the only place we found it. And it's a perfectly – square piece of with blocks, like the mosquitoes aren't going to cross this street. Don't worry, they're not going to fly there. They're going to stay right within the perimeters here. And you, I mean, it's kind of you have to look at it with some sort of humor, because it is kind of silly.
Well, others have wondered if, I mean, there's a silliness, but also a scathingness in some of your commentary. Janet Maslin, the New York Times, points out that you're kind of skewering the nature of our country right now in the center of the new book, because there's a reality show, Bayou Brethren. It's a duck dynasty, except there's a group of brothers who are actually from Wisconsin who have been trained how to speak Cajun.
They have a Cajun dialect. So, yes. Yeah, sure.
And what's the name of their church?
Oh, I've got, it's the Holy Tabernacle of Chickapaw, something like that. They had a fake church built so that they could give fake sermons. If you write satire, you're looking at the whole big picture, what's going on in the country. And that whole section of the novel was devised and written long before the Republican convention this summer, when one of the actual Duck Dynasty guys gets up and addresses the grand old party of the United States. I mean, I couldn't have invented that. Tom Wolfe couldn't have invented that scene. So if you're writing satire, you're trying to stay ahead of the absurdity, and sometimes it catches up with you. And this is the year I think it's catching up.
Well, and your character, who allegedly runs this chicken farm or something, again, who is in reality from Wisconsin with his brothers, turns out to be, you know, he says racist things, and
sure,
he's got people who believe him.
They worship him. They hang on every word. And I mean, he's just an accordion player from Wisconsin, and he's trained to be a redneck reality star. And all of a sudden, he's looking himself in the mirror, because there's a guy on the other side who actually is believing all the stuff that he's saying.
Well,
and that's what I think is a real phenomenon, is that you all the talk that, and the hate and the bigotry that you stir up with rhetoric sometimes comes home to roost. And in this particular, for this particular character, who's really just trying to make a buck on TV, he's now facing somebody who's really dangerous, who thinks everything he says is gospel.
Wow, there's another reality, former reality TV show star that I can think of that's been accused of saying things that might be taken the wrong way by people.
Well, sure, but he's playing to the crowd, and he's playing to the same crowd.
And you wrote this before?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That part before – I mean, I was working on this book, well into this book, by the time Trump even announced his candidacy.
Yeah.
That's the point.
Look, what do you think is going to happen in Florida, Carl Hyson?
In Florida? Well –
the swingingest of swing states.
The swingingest of swing – you know, first of all, every 4 years we go through this torture of – none of us there want to have any responsibility for what happens in the president. Not since the year 2000. It was a national humiliation. The hanging chads, In our view, we're lucky that they still let us even vote. So we would rather that it come down to Ohio, if possible, or Pennsylvania, or one of the other swing states.
Any place but
Florida. But I can tell you this, that Florida is a very diverse place, you know, and so it's not something you can make a prediction on very easily, except to say that, you know, Obama won there twice, Bill Clinton won there. We have a lot of Hispanic voters. We have a lot of African-American voters. And there are lots and lots of women voters. And in those three categories, Mr. Trump isn't doing very well. But I don't know. A lot can happen in the next, you know, what is it, 60 interminable days?
Miami Herald columnist and author Kyle Hyacin. The latest book is Razor Girl. Google it. Carl, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, by the way, worth noting, new polls show Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump tying in many battleground states. One poll shows Trump leading in Florida. So with apologies to Carl, his state may decide the election.
This November, voters in 9 states will decide whether to change the laws on marijuana use. 5 states are voting on legalizing recreational marijuana, 4 on medical. But even with all the states that already have legal weed in one form or another, authorities are having difficulty handling people who drive while stoned and how to test drivers for marijuana. Marilyn Hustis is a professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and a former investigator at the National Institute on Drug Abuse. She joins us. And Marilyn, what do we know about how marijuana affects driving? Is it similar to the way alcohol does?
In some ways, it's similar, but it's actually a very different drug and has quite different effects on the brain that will impair a person's ability to drive safely.
In what way?
So, for instance, with alcohol, people tend not to know they're impaired. With cannabis, many of the individuals have an idea that they're impaired and try to compensate for it. The problem is that they're not able to. So one of the things cannabis does that's most important is really affect the brain and your ability to make decisions, to actually take in all the information from your environment, to evaluate it, and then to make a decision on the proper course of action. The other major area of impairment is with motor control. So not only deciding what you should do, but the time it takes you to react to the event, like a child coming out of a street on a bicycle and having to take that in, make a decision, swerve to the left, stop, whatever it is you have to do, and to begin that process is greatly slowed.
So one of the things that's come up when we've talked about this issue before is that it's very difficult in the states where marijuana is legal for authorities to test drivers for whether they've been using marijuana because they can't tell whether they were just using it or whether they used it a few weeks ago. What do we know about the testing at this point?
So we know a lot. I've been studying cannabis and its effects for more than 25 years, and we have a lot of data. And actually, in our laboratory, when we tested chronic frequent cannabis smokers who had used on a daily basis for very long periods of time, that we discovered that you could measure the active psychoactive component in cannabis in someone's blood for a long period of time.
So it's not as easy right now to tell if somebody just smoked pot as opposed to just had a drink.
It's not as easy, but there are ways to do it. So, for instance, right now, we're focusing on either coming up with a good roadside behavioral test where we could see if someone was impaired, or come up with a test that can tell you whether they've used recently or not. Two things I want to make sure that I tell you. The first thing is that the THC, which is that active component in cannabis that affects people, disappears from the blood very quickly. And the reason is because it likes fat. It's lipophilic. And it gets in, you know, you smoke it, it goes into your lungs, right to your heart, and straight to your brain. And all the tissues pull that drug out of the blood. So one of our big problems is that currently in the United States, it takes about 1.4 to 4 hours before they get the person's blood. And during that time, the THC can totally disappear from the blood. So we've got to be able to take samples right at the roadside. So we're looking at saliva or oral fluid to do a test right at the roadside to see the frequency of use. Also, there's a lot of industry working on a breathalyzer, something that could measure it like we measure alcohol at the side of the road. The other issue is to see if we can come up with a way to test someone like we have our field sobriety test now. They are do a good job for picking up cannabis, but they were obviously designed for alcohol. So we're trying to come up with that or a handheld device that could test for impairment.
But when you say we're trying to come up with and we're working on this and we're working on that, it could be a matter of months before people in states like California and Massachusetts with big populations are able to legally use marijuana. And it doesn't sound like authorities have figured out exactly how to test at the roadside easily and make a determination if the person should be arrested or not.
So I disagree with that. So we have oral fluid testing devices currently. The other thing in my laboratory, we've identified some other cannabinoid markers other than THC that are only present in the blood for short periods of time. So what we generally hope is that there is an evidence of impairment. So for instance, a policeman has to observe that they're weaving or driving very slow in their lane, which then gives them the cause to stop them and take a sample. And then they'll do field sobriety tests as well. So it's not a single component of just the testing. It's also the behavior that caused them to be stopped.
Well, Marilyn Huestis, professor at University of Maryland School of Medicine and a former investigator at the National Institute on Drug Abuse, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.